Welcome back, Hemming Brainiacs, to the Hemming Brainiac-a-thon. We are talking about The Red and the Black, Chapter 6, Book 2, Chapter 6. But first, what... I mean, I think this every day, but just today, I just went... To the extent where I'm saying it now, I went, America... What the hell are you doing? Like, I say that every day because I use Reddit and I just roll, like, I, you know, just go on popular or, you know, the homepage sort of thing. Just what, not my subscriptions. What's the one called? Popular? All? Whatever. I just roll my eyes every 15 seconds. I go, oh my God. 15 seconds? Oh my God. And I just go, what's happening over there? What is happening over there? Kanye is running for president. I can't take you seriously anymore. Sorry. I mean, Trump, I mean, already you've actually got Trump as a president. So, like, I haven't taken you seriously since then. Don't take that the wrong way. And I know most American listeners probably didn't want Trump in, you know, but somehow he got him. So, you know, I don't blame you. I'm just saying, as a whole, from an outsider of America, looking at the headlines that roll out of America, what are you guys doing? You know, yesterday there were 87 new coronavirus cases in Australia. And so we're talking about closing the state borders, locking it down, going back into lockdown and making sure it doesn't spread, making sure we can, you know, stay on top of it. 87 cases. Yesterday in America, there were 47,000 new cases. 47,000. And you're opening up your restrictions? What? What are you doing? And I watch a lot of, like, American podcasts and stuff, you know, a lot of podcasters. And they've just got guests in the studio and they talk about coronavirus. Just Joe Rogan with, like, 5 different guests per week. And he says how they get tests and all this. They don't get tests. It's such bullshit. And they... Like, even today I was watching the H3 podcast and they run, I don't know if you know H3, pretty crappy podcast. I don't really even like it. I don't know why I was watching it. But they've got a brand called Teddy Fresh, which is their clothing label. And they, you know, that's their kind of side hustle. They're always promoting it through their podcast. And one of the staff at Teddy Fresh got coronavirus confirmed. So they were saying, oh, you know, it's close to home now. And they were saying how... the business is still going. They're still shipping out their merchandise. But some of the other employees have had to get tests or they're quarantining, that kind of thing. And, but then they keep saying, like, oh, but when we're there, we all wear masks. We all wear masks whenever we're there together. And it's like, you're sitting in a room now, a group of you podcasting, and we can see none of you have masks on. So stop pretending like you're always wearing masks. What are you doing over there? And why is masks still a debate over there? Put a mask on. I still hear the argument, like, it doesn't stop you from catching it. I still hear that. And it's like, no, it doesn't stop you from catching it. No one was ever saying it stops you from catching it. It stops you from spreading it because you have it for several weeks before you even know you've got it, or you have it and you're asymptomatic, you don't even know you've got it. So you wear a mask to stop it spreading, not from stop yourself from catching it. And, like, we were all on board with that in every other country in, like, January. we knew that was why you wore a mask. I mean, the Japanese wear masks every flu season for decades. And it's not because they don't want to catch the flu. It's because if they've got the flu virus, they don't want to spread it. They've known that for decades, right? Why are you still debating whether to wear a mask or not? Madness. Madness. You guys are embarrassing yourself. Sorry to my American listeners. I love America. I really do. I wish I was American. I have always, sort of thing, you know? Well, I mean, Australia's pretty great too. I do love being Australian. I'm not saying I would prefer to be American, but you know what I mean? Like, America just feels like my culture in a weird way. So I'm not saying I dislike America. I'm just saying that, like, what are you doing? An episode of Community, the best episode, was removed from Netflix because what's his name? I can't think of the... Oh, Chang. I had Changnesia there for a second. Chang wears this black makeup to be a dark elf because they're playing Dungeons and Dragons and he gets too into the cosplay. But it's like black ink black, like as black as night, black makeup to a comedic effect. And then the racist character makes a joke that it looks like blackface and to sort of make himself look better. And so it's like acknowledged that that's the joke. It got removed from Netflix. Why? What? Why are you ruining everything, America? Why? Like, I don't know. I don't know. I just can't stop rolling my eyes at American headlines at the moment. So, you know what? Chuck Kanye in as the president. Who knows? Things might get better. Oh, dear. Anyway, I really, you know, I'm probably ostracizing the majority of my audience by having an America rant. And if not, you're probably there going, yeah, I know. I'm sorry. Yeah, what can I say? I'm embarrassed too. Which I think is the appropriate response at the moment. Sometimes you just got to eat humble pie. And there's plenty of times in my past where I've gone, yeah, us Australians are pretty dumb. I am. What can I do? What can I say? I'm sorry on our behalf. All right. I've done that. We're dumb. We've done our dumb share of dumb things. We've got like, we're not smart people, us Australians. We've got the worst engineers in the world, I think. I remember when we had the Sydney Olympics year 2000. In our opening ceremony, we had this bit where people were coming, you know, in the dancing and the big spectacle in costumes. And they were the weirdest costumes. It was like the Hills hoist, which is like a clothesline. And like corrugated iron. And I was like, what are these costumes? And they were like costumes of all the Australian inventions. And they were, yeah, they were things like the Hills hoist, which is a type of clothesline, corrugated iron, and maybe like a half dozen other things that are like around the world. You'll see these things. They came from Australia. It's like, you know, if America or the UK or, you know, Japan did that in their opening ceremony, like had people come in dressed as all the things that their country had invented, the opening ceremony from the 86 Olympics would still be going right now because they've invented so many things. I don't even know where the 86 Olympics was, or if there indeed was one. Was that the one in, wasn't that in Japan? Did I get that right? Where was the 86 Olympics held? Oh, there was no 86 Olympics. Jesus. Los Angeles in 84. There you go. There you go. Oh, there you go. I'm dumb. I said the wrong year. But yeah, there you go. Well, Los Angeles, if you guys had done the same thing, you'd still be opening ceremony right now with all the American inventions. So you know what? Australians are dumb. Don't get me wrong. We're dumb. But you guys are currently, for this year's rankings, the 2020 dumb competition, the Dumb Olympics, you guys are gold medals just raining. Just raining gold medals. We all have our day in the sun, you know, or our day in the gold, dumb gold Olympics sun. And this is your one. I'm not trying to hate. I'm just venting my frustrations. And this is not the format. This is not the this is not my soapbox to do that. So let's move on and actually talk about the book, shall we? I'll shut my stupid mouth. Book 2, chapter 6. Felix Culper, the book. Felix Culper is a literary term. And Swims to the Mama Fishy went and looked it up. I was hoping someone would look it up because it's the most relevant literary term, I think, for this book. So, Felix Culper. In a literary context, the term Felix Culper can describe how a series of unfortunate events will eventually lead to a happier outcome. Yeah, it's something like that, but not necessarily always eventually lead. It can just be like a happy accident sort of thing, or a series of happy accidents. So, like, think of a character who's happy-go-lucky, and every time they stumble, they end up ahead, if that makes sense. So, that's the fortunate fall, as in, like, it's a fall, but it ends up being lucky that you fell, Felix Culper. And Julian, like, what happened here? Julian got into an argument, said, screw it, let's have a duel, right? And gets shot in the arm, but that's neither here nor there, because he's just made a great friend of the guy who he's gotten in the argument with and gotten shot by. And now that guy's come up with this lie that he is of kind of a wealthy, from an important family. And if that lie gets kind of validated and becomes like, you know, Julian's canon in society, then he can launch ahead in the social social scene. Because the thing that holds you back, no matter how much you achieve in an aristocracy, is if you're not from an aristocratic descent, you can't get ahead. So you need to be, what's the word? Not validated, but like legitimized, I suppose. Like an illegitimate child cannot inherit the status of their aristocratic parents. But if they get legitimized, now they can. That's what happens to Pierre in War and Peace. And so he's sort of being getting this fictional legitimacy, which will then qualify him to rise up the social ranks massively, right? And so by getting in a fight and getting shot, he ends up like launching himself up the social stratosphere. Every time he does some stupid little trip, he lands 5 rungs up the social ladder. It's quite humorous, really. And the second discussion prompt was this: hell of a way to make friends. Swim said the Mama Fishy said the epigraph. This quote cannot be identified with any known Latin author named Gratius. Adding to the character list, Comte Altamira is an exile and liberal who attends the Marquise de Mole's salon. He has a price on his head in his own country for challenging the political order. Exciting. Charles de Beauvoisis, also called Chevalier de Beauvoisis, is the diplomat who fights Julian in a duel. He is also the cousin of Madame de Renal. Oh, I didn't know that bit. Laura Weistitcher, this is the 4th book about adultery, and now the 2nd, 3rd, if you include War and Peace, with a duel. It's also will be the 5th book about adultery too, because there's some of that in War and Peace. I'm beginning to think Hemingway likes these themes. Yeah. They are. There's a lot of similarities between these books, isn't there, now that we've kind of gotten this far through the list. Swim said, I don't know, sex and violence sells books and movie tickets. Per Wikipedia, the theme of adultery has been used in a wide range of literature through the ages and has served as a theme for some notable works such as Anna Karenina and Madame Bovary. As a theme, it brings intense emotions into the foreground and has consequences for all concerned. It also automatically brings its own conflict between the people concerned and between sexual desires and sense of loyalty. Love triangle, you know. It's not exactly a love triangle, is it? That's more in a blossoming romance. This is more adultery, is, yeah, kind of the opposite, but still. Okay, anyway. Jan Brunt said, just catching up after a few days on holiday. Welcome back, Andrew Lewis. That's me. I really appreciate your thoughtful response to our discussion last week. Ah, yep. Thanks. Here in America, we're having a lot of hard conversations about how unconscious biases shape the world in which we live. I suspect you feel, as I do, that literature has played a huge part in how we view our fellow humans. This community has given me space to thoughtfully approach and discuss some classic literature, and for that I am grateful. You're a podcaster I never tire of. Thanks for all you give of yourself to this community. Thanks. Oh, that's nice. It's my pleasure. Yeah, it's strangely, literature has this kind of exception to every rule, doesn't it? I feel, because it's like the last sacred playing space for preservation of old traditions that we've outgrown, you know, as a culture or as a collection of cultures. But I think, like, you can't just, once you move past something as a way of life, you can't then just deny that that was ever how things were, you know. And I think with a lot of media at the moment, movies and shows and all kinds of things, that's sort of what they're trying to do in a big way. Like, even what I was just saying about Community deleting one episode because it has a joke where the guy, where the joke is that he's accidentally put on blackface, and now they've removed that, saying that it's blackface. But it's like, the blackface was mocking black people. But, and I don't know. Anyway, sure, you can say, look, we won't make episodes of shows that do that anymore. That went too far. Okay, all right. If that's going to be your policy to not do that anymore, that's okay. But don't go and just, like, delete things that you did 10 years ago. You know? I don't know. I just don't know. It's strange. But then maybe it's because it's a monetized platform where they want to say, well, we don't want to be making money off of a thing that we wouldn't produce today because of our ethics. I don't know. It's just like, it's a shame, because I don't think anyone was getting offended by that joke. In fact, if you're the kind of person who is offended by proper blackface, which probably most people are, then I think you would appreciate that joke bringing light to, you know, why blackface is offensive by having this character goof it up and accidentally do that, you know? Anyway. I just have this deep fear that literature will, the same thing will happen, you know, and it will be just such a silly thing to let happen in this world. Great chapter, says Jan Brunt. It was a great chapter, wasn't it? And it moved so quickly. There was just like, there was these moments where a sentence was like, and then this whole thing happened. Like, he just beat someone up, you know, dragged the guy off the carriage and beat him up. And it was like, that just happened, okay, in a sentence. Like, we've gone from here to here. And the same with the duel. It was like, the duel was over quickly, blah, blah, blah. He got shot. And it's like, oh, that there was no, like, building the tension or building up the moment. Just, like, snappy. Great chapter. I'm really enjoying Julian's adventures in Paris. Julian is a neophyte, and this allows the reader to learn along with him. Maybe this wasn't Stendhal's aim when writing, but now that our world is nothing like Julian's, seeing it through his naivety is a great narrative device. Oh. Well, now we're going to read chapter 7, which is named An Attack of Gout. So this should be nice. Gout. Fun times. And I was promoted, not on my merits, but because my master had the gout. Bartoletti. Perhaps the reader is surprised at this free and almost friendly tone. We have omitted to mention that for the last 6 months the Marquise had been kept at home by an attack of gout. Mademoiselle de la Mole and her mother were at Hyres, staying with the Marquise's mother. Comte Norbert saw his father fleetingly only. They were on excellent terms, but had nothing to say to one another. Monsieur de la Mole, reduced to the company of Julien, was amazed to discover that he possessed some ideas. He made him read the newspapers. Soon the young secretary was capable of excerpting interesting passages. There was a new paper the Marquise abhorred. He had sworn never to read it, yet he mentioned it every day. Julien laughed. The Marquise, exasperated with modern times, set him to reading Livy. Julien's improvised translation from the Latin text entertained him. One day, the Marquise addressed him in the tone of over-elaborate politeness that Julien often found irksome. "Permit me, my dear Sorrel, to make you the gift of a blue coat. When it is convenient to you to put it on and call on me, you will, in my eyes, be the youngest brother of the Comte de Chaulnes, that is to say, the son of the old Duke, my friend." Julien did not really understand what this purported. That very evening he hazarded a visit dressed in blue. The Marquise treated him as an equal. Julien's heart was quite capable of appreciating genuine politeness, but he had had no idea of its nuances. Before this little game of the Marquise, he would have sworn it was impossible to be treated by him with greater courtesy. "What an admirable gift," he said to himself. And when he rose to leave, the Marquise made his apologies for being unable to see him out because of his gout. A curious idea started to worry Julien. "Can he be making fun of me?" He went to ask the advice of Abbé Pirard, who, less than polite than the Marquise, answered only by giving a whistle and then changing the subject. The following morning, Julien presented himself to the Marquise, attired in black and carrying his portfolio of letters ready for signature. He was received in the old manner. That evening, blue-coated, there was a different tone again and quite as much politeness as the night before. "Since these visits, which you have been so kind as to make to a sick old man, don't bore you too grievously. You might tell me about all the little events of your life, but frankly, without thinking of anything else and telling the tale clearly and entertainingly. For it is essential to be amused," continued the Marquise. "That's the only real thing in life. A man can't save my life in battle every day or make me a present of a million, but if I had Rivarol here, next to my couch, every single day he would spare me an hour of pain and boredom. I knew him well at Hamburg during the emigration." And the Marquise told Julien anecdotes of Rivarol and the citizens of Hamburg who used to meet in groups of four so as to work out the meaning of his witticisms. Thrown back on the society of his young Abe, Monsieur de la Mole desired to liven him up. He felt himself bound to tease Julien's pride. Since the truth was being demanded of him, Julien resolved to tell it to the full. But keeping back two things, his fanatical admiration for the name that would annoy the Marquise greatly, and his perfect lack of belief, which did not look at all good in a future priest. His little entanglement with the Chevalier de Beauvoisis came just at the right moment. The Marquise laughed till he cried at the scene of the café on the Rue Saint-Honoré, with the coachman overwhelming him with filthy insults. It was a time of perfect frankness in the relations between patron and protégé. Monsieur de la Mole developed a great interest in his singular individual. To begin with, he indulged Julien's ridiculous characteristics in order to be entertained by them. Soon, though, he found it more amusing to correct unobtrusively the young man's odd ways of seeing things. Other provincials who came to Paris admire everything, reflected the Marquise. This one detests everything. They develop far too much affectation, he too little, and idiots take him for an idiot. The attack of gout was prolonged by the excessive winter cold and lasted several months. "One can become very fond of a beautiful spaniel," said the Marquise to himself. "Why should I be so ashamed of becoming fond of this little Abe? He's an original. I treat him like a son very well. Where's the harm in that? The whim, if it permits, could cost me a diamond worth 500 louis of my will." Once the Marquis had understood his protege's firm character, he began to entrust him with some new business every day. Julian realized with dismay that this grand seigneur sometimes gave him contradictory instructions on the same subject. That could be dangerously compromising, so Julian no longer proceeded without bringing along a register in which he wrote decisions down. Then had the Marquis initial them. Julian had hired a clerk to transcribe decisions relative to each piece of business in a special file. The file also contained copies of all letters. At first, the idea seemed the height of absurdity and tedium, but in less than 2 months the Marquis felt its advantages. Julian suggested to him that they engaged a clerk from a bank who should make it his business to record in double entry all the credits and debits relating to the estates with those administration Julian had been charged. These measures so clarified his own affairs for the Marquis that he was able to undertake 2 or 3 new speculations without the help of his broker, who perpetually stole from him. "Take 3,000 francs for yourself," he said one day to his young minister. "My behaviour might be made into a scandal, monsieur." "Then what would you do?" demanded the Marquis testily. "You might be so kind as to make a formal agreement and write it in the register in your own hand. This agreement would allow me a sum of 3,000 francs. Besides, it was Monsieur l'Abbé Pirard who had the idea of all that accounting." The Marquis, with a bored expression like that of a Marquis de Moncard, listening to his steward, Monsieur Poisson, reading his accounts, wrote out the agreement. In the evenings, when Julian appeared in his blue coat, there was never any question of his business. The Marquis's kindness so cosseted our hero's ever-vulnerable self-esteem that soon, despite himself, he felt a sort of attachment to the pleasant old man. It was not that Julian was receptive in the Parisian sense of the word, but he was not a monster, and no one, since the death of the old surgeon major, had showed him so much kindness. He was amazed to realize that the Marquis displayed a courteous tactfulness with regard to his feelings that he had never found in the old surgeon major. Eventually he understood that the surgeon was prouder of his cross than the Marquis of his blue riband. The Marquis had a lord for a father. One day, as the morning sessions drew to a close, Julian dressed in black coat and there for business so amused the Marquis that he kept him on for 2 more hours and was absolutely determined to present him with some banknotes his broker had just brought in from the stock exchange. "I trust, Monsieur le Marquis, that I shall not depart from the profound respect I owe you if I beg to put in a word." "Speak on, my friend." "That, Monsieur le Marquis, deigns to allow me to refuse this gift. It is not to the man in black that it is offered. It would altogether inhibit the manners so very kindly tolerated in the man in blue." He bowed most respectfully and went out without looking back. This piece of behaviour intrigued the Marquis. That evening he told the Abbé Pirard about it. "I must confess something to you at last, my dear Abbé. I know about Julian's birth, and I authorize you to fail to keep this confidence a secret." "His behaviour this morning was noble," thought the Marquis, "and I'm taking it upon myself to ennoble him." Shortly after this, the Marquis was at last able to go out of doors. "Go and spend 2 months in London," said he to Julian. "Special couriers and others will bring you the letters I receive, together with my notes on them. You can prepare the answers and send them back to me, putting in each letter with the reply. I have worked out that the delay will be only 5 days. While travelling in the post coach in the road to Calais, Julian was amazed at the futility of the supposed business on which he was being sent. We will pass in total silence over the feelings of hatred, almost horror, with which he stepped on English soil. We know about his infatuation with Bonaparte. In each officer he saw a Sir Hudson Lowe, in each great lord a Bathurst, ordaining the infamies of St. Helena, and receiving a 10-year ministry for his reward. In London he at last understood the higher forms of foppery. He made friends with the young Russian aristocrats, who initiated him. "You have been predestined for the life, my dear Sorrel," they told him. "You possess, naturally, that glacial air, 1,000 leagues from the feelings of the moment, that we must try so hard to adopt. You haven't understood your century," Prince Korosov told him. "Always do the opposite of what is expected of you. That, upon my honour, is the only religion of the times. Don't be wild or affected. Be because people will always expect wildness and affectation, and therefore the precept wouldn't be borne out. Julian covered himself in glory one day in the Duke of Fitzfalk's house, where he had been invited, together with Prince Korosov. They were kept waiting for an hour. The manner with which Julian conducted himself amongst the 20 or so others also waiting is still talked about by young secretaries to the embassy in London. He had an inimitable air. Despite his friendship with the dandies, he wanted to visit the celebrated Philip Vane, the only philosopher England has produced since Locke. He found him doing his 7th year in prison. The aristocracy does not trifle in this country, Julian reflected. What's more, Vane is dishonoured, vilified, etc. Julian found him in the best of spirits, the aristocratic fury against him banished boredom. That, said Julian, leaving the prison, is the only cheerful man I have met in England. The concept that is most useful to tyrants is the concept of God, Vane had said to him. We suppressed the rest of his system as being cynical. Then, when he got back, what amusing idea have you brought me from England? Monsieur de la Mole asked him. He was silent. What idea have you brought, amusing or not? The Marquise insisted sharply. Primo, said Julian, the most sensible Englishman is mad for an hour a day. He is haunted by the demon of suicide, which is the national deity. Secundo, wit and genius lose 25% of their value on landing in England. Tertio, there is nothing in the world so beautiful, lovable, and moving as the English countryside. It's my turn now, said the Marquise. Primo, why did you go and remark at the Russian ambassadors that there were 300,000 men of 25 in France passionately wanting war? Did you imagine that that would please the monarchs? One doesn't know what to do when talking to our grand diplomats, replied Julian. They have a passion for starting serious discussion. If you stick to journalistic commonplaces, you pass for a fool. If you allow yourself something true and novel, they're astounded, don't know how to answer, and at 7 o'clock next morning they cause you to be informed by the first secretary of the embassy that you have been tactless. Not at all bad, said the Marquise, laughing. Nevertheless, I am prepared to wager, Monsieur the philosopher, that you haven't worked out what you went to England to do. I beg your pardon, replied Julian. I went there to dine once a week with the ambassador of the king, who is the most courteous of men. You went there to find that cross you see there, said the Marquise. I don't want you to leave off your black coat, but I have become used to the more entertaining relation I've cultivated with the man in blue. Until further orders, make sure you understand this. When I see this cross, you will be the younger son of my friend, the Duc de Chaulnes, who, without his knowing it, has been practicing diplomacy for the last 6 months. Now take notice, added the Marquise, with an extremely serious air, and cutting short any manifestations of gratitude, that I have no wish at all, that you move out of your station in life. That's always a mistake, and as great a misfortune for the patron as for the protege. When my lawsuits begin to bore you, or you no longer suit me, I will ask for a fine living for you, like that of our friend, the A. Perard, and nothing more, added the Marquise in a very dry voice. This cross set Julian's pride at rest. He talked much more readily. He often felt offended, and less often thought himself the target of those kinds of remarks, capable of being interpreted as less than polite, that can easily escape anyone in a lively conversation. To this cross he owed also a remarkable visit. This was from Monsieur le Baron de Valenod, who had come to Paris to present his thanks for his baronessy to the minister, and to negotiate with him. He was about to be appointed mayor of Verrières, replacing Monsieur de Renal. Julian laughed to himself heartily when Monsieur de Valenod led him to understand that it had just been discovered that Monsieur de Renal was a Jacobin. The reality was that in the impending new elections, the new baron was the minister's candidate, and that within the electoral college of the department, which in truth was very ultra, Monsieur de Renal was being supported by the Liberals. It was no good at all, Julian, trying to find out anything about Madame de Renal. The Baron appeared to remember their ancient rivalry and was impenetrable. He ended by asking for Julian's father's vote in the coming elections. Julian promised to write to him. You ought, Monsieur le Chevalier, to introduce me to Monsieur le Marquise de la Mole. In fact, I ought to do it, thought Julian, but such a scoundrel. To tell you the truth, he answered, I am too junior a personage in the Hotel de la Mole to take it upon myself to introduce anyone. Julian told the Marquis everything. That evening he reported Valenod's ambition, as well as his career and actions since 1814. Not only, Monsieur de la Mole replied in a very serious tone, not only will you introduce me to the new Baron tomorrow, but I will invite him to dinner the day after. This fellow shall be one of our new prefects. In that case, Julian replied coolly, I request the post of director of the poorhouse for my father. First class, said the Marquis, becoming very cheerful again. Granted, I had expected a sermon. You are growing up. Monsieur de Valenod informed Julian that the holder of the lottery concession in Verrières had just died. Julian thought it would be amusing to give the place to Monsieur de Cholin, that old cretin whose petition he had long ago found in Monsieur de la Mole's room. The Marquise laughed heartily at this petition, which Julian recited to him while arranging for him to sign the letter requesting the position from the Ministry of Finance. Hardly had Monsieur de Cholin been appointed when Julian learned that a departmental deputation had begged the place for Monsieur Gros, the celebrated geometrician. This generous man had an income of no more than 1,400 francs, yet had lent 600 each year to the dying concessionaire to help him support his family. Julian was astounded at what he had done, but that is nothing, he said to himself. It will be necessary to do a great many other injustices if I am to succeed, and to know how to cloak them under fine sentimental phrases. Poor Monsieur Gros, he is the one who deserves a cross. It's I that have it, and I must behave in the spirit of the government that gave it me. Alrighty, there we go, Julian. Bit of a mover and shaker, this young Julian. Alright, head over to the subreddit, have a little chit chat. Thanks for listening, and I will see you tomorrow.